Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Michael Leader.
I'm Hannah Strong.
And I'm Rogan Graham.
On the show this week, Tom Hardy is back with an alien on his back in Venom 2, Let There Be Carnage. Director Todd Haynes stops by to talk about his documentary about the legendary band The Velvet Underground. And in Film Club, we're going back to Todd Haynes' fictionalised glam rock drama, Velvet Goldmine. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Yes, listeners, a VVV exciting episode this week. Venom 2, Velvet Underground, Velvet Goldmine. Very exciting, and I'm very excited to welcome back Rogan Graham. Rogan, it's always a pleasure.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
How have you been doing? So we're about halfway through the London Film Festival as we speak, I believe. So have you managed to go out too much?
Yes, busy. I haven't seen as much as I liked, but last night I saw Ali and Ava, the Cleo Barnard film, which I thought was wonderful. And what else have I liked? I really loved Lingui, The Sacred Bonds, a film that's from a Chad director. And yeah, it's wonderful, but I'm hoping to cram more in the final weekend. Yeah,
I think we're all hoping to cram in as many films as possible. Of course, listeners, you may have been keeping up with our diary episodes, dispatches from the festival, where we've heard from many Little White Lies associates on the ground. Hannah, how's the festival been for you? Have you been enjoying your time? You were doing jury service, weren't you? Is that all wrapped up yet?
Yeah, let me clarify, that's film festival jury, not actual jury. I don't have any real influence in the world. We finished our deliberations yesterday. I'm not going to say who won, because I'm not sure when they're announcing it. So I feel like I could put my foot in it massively if I did. But it was super fun. My first kind of big film festival jury, which is kind of the plum gig all critics want, because you basically just watch films and people look after you for 4 days. But it was really interesting. Just kind of thinking about films like that, because you're not only thinking about, is this a good film? You're thinking about, what do you want to say with this award? And that's something we talked about a lot in our deliberation meeting, is, the Sutherland Award, which is the LFF First Feature Award, has a really rich history. People like Lynn Ramsey, Robert Eggers, Matty Diop, Julia Ducournau have like won this award, so it is kind of a big deal, and you don't want to be the one who picks the director that goes on to do nothing or just not make very good films. So we did think a lot about, you know, the kind of legacy and what we wanted to say, and yeah, it was very I would say a testing 4 days, you know, because you are just sat in a quite a small room at the BFI, just watching films back to back. I think at festivals, normally you have the energy of everyone else to feed off, but when there's only four of you in a room, it can be a little bit sort of more intense. But yeah, it was great. I've had a great festival so far. I've not seen very much because I have seen a lot because I've been to the jury, but in terms of big stuff at the festival, I've not seen a lot, but I really loved Power of the Dog. So that's my like highlight so far. But yeah, I think it's been a vintage year.
Yeah. Well, if the winner of the Sutherland this year does go on to be the next Lynn Ramsey, we can give credit to you.
Yeah.
If not,
like Guy Lodge credit taking
the rest
credit
of the jury
for Julia Ducournau, because she won with Raw, and he's like, "Ah, I remember when we gave her the Sutherland Award." That's what I want.
Well, yes, listeners, listen out for one more dispatch from the London Film Festival as it wraps up this weekend. As I said on those episodes, I've not seen much this year, but I did schlep up to London this week, but not to see a film for the London Film Festival. It was to see Venom 2, Let There Be Carnage, the big new release of this week, which we should kick off our new release review section with right now. Tom Hardy returns to the big screen as reporter Eddie Brock and his lovable alien symbiote Venom. Directed by Andy Serkis, this romantic comedy sequel takes the Marvel character, who's happiest when he's being bad, in a bold new direction as he's paired up with a new symbiote in town, Woody Harrelson's Cletus Kasady, aka Carnage. So, Venom 2018, a massively successful film, pretty divisive, but it had its very strong fans, two of whom we have on the podcast today, I believe. So, Hannah, you're all in on Venom, right?
Yeah. I just think the world is a dark place and I'm constantly being struck by a barrage of bad news. And if I can sit in a cinema for 90 minutes and just see Tom Hardy having the time of his life, then why wouldn't I love that, you know? I think it's a very simple premise. And Andy Serkis is a true ally to tired film critics everywhere.
So what's the deal with this sequel then? It's a wonderful 97 minutes compared to the bloated franchise superhero fare we usually get. But what are we getting in this sequel then? Is it more of the same, something a bit different?
I think basically they cottoned on pretty quickly. They've been the studio, and they cottoned on quite quickly to the fact that the thing people liked about Venom was how camp it was. It was, you know, they weren't there for the kind of the stuff in the laboratory with Jenny Slate saying symbiote, weirdly. They were there for, like, Tom Hardy jumping in a lobster tank and all the kind of just weird, slightly gross Venom stuff, basically. I mean, it sounds obvious, but the thing people really loved about Venom was Venom. So to me, it feels like with the sequel, they really just lent in to the kind of comedy, campy aspect of the story. And Kenny Marcel, the screenwriter, and I imagine Andy Serkis as well. I mean, you know, I think this is very much his vision. And when you hear him talk about it, he's very kind of enthusiastic and very very candid as well, in a way I don't think I'm particularly used to Marvel superhero directors being. I think sometimes they can be a bit coy because they're trying to get their sequel money. But this is just pure kind of, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense. It doesn't pretend to make a lot of sense. And it is just like 97 minutes of vibes, is how I would describe it. It is like the only way I could really describe it is like a little kid explaining a story to you. That's what the whole film feels like to me. But this kid is so enthusiastic. You're like, yeah, come on, yeah. Like, I'm totally with you, small child. And I think the additions that they make in terms of the cast are really strong. I think that Woody Harrelson is kind of the perfect foil to Tom Hardy because he matches his energy like 100%. You know, Tom Hardy's giving. I actually think like it's a pretty complex performance. You know, the guy's got to go from being kind of like Eddie Brock, the loser, to like Venom, the also loser, but like more unapologetic loser than Eddie. And then you've got, you know, Woody Harrelson just doing his like best natural born killers over again, which I'm always here to see. And yeah, I mean, it's a really simple premise. I think the first one, they made it so complicated. They were like, okay, we've got to add all this science stuff with Riz Ahmed's character. And this one's just a serial killer has escaped from prison and he's on the rampage. And for some reason, Eddie Brock is the only man who can stop him. And I think I really enjoyed the fact that in an age of like superhero movies having to be 3 hours long because they are so complicated, Andy and Kenny said, nah, man, we're not here for that. We're just going to make it 97 minutes. And it's going to be an incredibly straightforward story of this odd couple having a fight and then kind of the film trying to get them back together for like the big showdown. And yeah, I was, you know, what can I say? I love Venom. That's he's one of my boys.
And as you say, large stretches of the 97 minutes, I get the sense that what if there was a longer previous version of this film, what they cut out was mostly plot business. Because what long stretches of the 97 minutes entails is the bickering between Eddie and Venom, some great scenes in their sort of dingy loft flat they have, where Tom Hardy as a performance is kind of at war with himself. And that's where Andy Serkis is a pretty good pick as a director for this, somebody who's had to do lots of motion capture in the past, but also was a master in the late 90s, early 2000s of the really intense, internalized, complex performance. And he turned his back on that to become a filmmaker. But Tom Hardy staking his reputation and the takings from the first Venom on a film like this is quite interesting. I don't think I enjoy it as much as you do, though, Hannah. Rogan, so what did you make of this? What did you like about the first Venom, and was that reflected in this?
Yeah, I loved it. I remember seeing the first Venom in the cinema, and I was the only one who laughed at anything. It was like a packed house. I was the only one who laughed. At the end, I was the only one who like looked happy. Everyone looked kind of angry, confused, because how dare they not engage with the law, or like, you know, take this seriously, this, you know, these fictional creatures, how dare they, you know, treat it like it's fun. And that's why I loved it. And the fact that they just went full steam ahead with that for the second one. I mean, yeah, the screening we were at yesterday, a lot of the times it was just Hannah and I laughing, and laughing because it's funny, not laughing because in a mocking way, because there are some really funny jokes, or jokes that we found really funny. I found really funny. It was great. It was a marriage drama, a buddy cop comedy type thing, and that's it. They come apart. They're bickering. They're arguing, and then they reunite to save the world. That very basic tried and true formula. And I had a great time, and I like that they were kind of like, well, people didn't like the first one, we have nothing to lose. Basically, it's like, you're either gonna see it or you're not, like, let's just have fun. And they really did. And yeah, Woody Harrelson's great, Michelle Williams, it's like, yeah, she's just like an incredible actress, because you know, a lot of the discussion around the first one is like, she's so above this. And she said in an interview, like, well, if I'll do one Venom a year if it means I get to like fund like four Kelly Reichardt films, or there was, I'm misquoting her, but it was something along those lines. But you still believe her, like, she's still in it, she's still like turning in a great performance. And yeah, Tom Hardy is just like sweaty and stressed out for most of the film, and
like all of us,
yeah, and just like running around trying his best, and I just felt so represented by that. No, but I had a great time with it, and it's big and it's loud and it's weird and funny. And we haven't even touched on the club scene.
Oh, which... God. So, you know what? Like, for years, Marvel have kept saying, this is our first openly queer superhero, first openly queer character in the MCU. And they've made this big fuss about how in the Eternals, they're having the first out superhero. There is literally a scene in Venom Let There Be Carnage where Venom goes to a rave and he's wearing all these glow sticks, bless him, and he looks so cute. And he gets on the stage and Little Sims is performing, which I think is just like a masterstroke. She's performing her song Venom, which has nothing to do with the film Venom. But apparently Tom Hardy told Andy Serkis, he was like, did you know that Little Sims has a song called Venom? And he was like, oh my God, we've got to ask her to be in the film. And so they built this scene around Little Sims having a song called Venom. And so, you know, she's there, she's singing her song, doing her thing. And Venom being an alien who doesn't really understand popular culture, assumes that they're like singing the song for him. And it was just incredibly sweet. And he gets on the stage and he says, "I am out of the Eddie closet." And I was like, there we go. Like, queer representation in a Marvel movie. I don't want to be like the, you know, the half-assed, like, token character. I want to be the slimy symbiote, like, weirdo. I'm like, yeah, this is what I've been crying out for. I think it is just like, Andy Serkis has said in interviews that he really leaned into the kind of like the quasi-romantic, campy, potentially gay representation angle, and I am so thankful to this man for that. I think it is like it works really beautifully, and it doesn't feel like they're kind of poking fun. It just feels like they're like kind of like baiting the weird like homophobic like Marvel fans. You know, they're saying like, yeah, and what are you gonna do about it? We've made the movie. You can't argue with the movie. So
I suppose it's the distinction between poking fun and having fun.
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is a film that is having fun, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also something that is very intriguing about this film. I did not enjoy this film anywhere near as much as you two did, but it is so intriguing that in the way that this undercuts so much of the pomp of the superhero genre, it's in its own way doing Deadpool better than Deadpool in the way that it's almost parodying or undercutting everything we expect and the sort of importance. As you say, a scene like that, which when this scene happens, and when the equivalent scene will happen in the real MCU, it's going to happen properly and with a lot of pomp and circumstance around it, and they're going to have lots of headlines saying, we've finally done this, whereas Venom will just have a lot of fun with it. It's a very odd film, and Tom Hardy, you know, fair play to him in a massive movie that's going to be making 9-figure box office. He's bringing a performance that's almost like outsider art in a way. He really isn't. It's outside of big screen blockbuster movie acting what he's doing, and he's leveraged his stardom to do that. But let's put some scores on this. Hannah, I'll come to you first. In anticipation, enjoyment, in retrospect.
You know, I was talking about this last night with a friend of mine at a bar, because he said to me, "Well, surely you can't give it 4 stars because it's you know." It's Venom. And I said, you know, I fundamentally, yes, I can see the problems with this film. I can see that I think the pacing is off, and I wonder if they were told to cut something. As much as I love the fact it's 97 minutes, I could have happily spent another half an hour in there. And I think that poor Naomi Harris's character gets a raw deal. I think they should have just cut her completely, because it's so painful to watch her being given just like nothing to do. Bless her, she's really trying, she's really like going for it. We're talking like Pirates of the Caribbean 3 like levels of commitment to the bit. But anyway, all this to say that, yeah, I mean, it's 4s across the board for me. I had a great time. I really did, and I will probably go and see it again. I just think it's so rare that films create that genuine sense of just like fun and joy that you have as a kid when you go to the cinema. And if that makes me a Marvel shill, then so be it. I'm more than happy to shill for something as kind of fun and warm-hearted as, I think, Venom, Let There Be Carnage is.
Rogan, what are your scores?
I would say probably 5 in anticipation. Like, I got so stressed out every time I saw the release date pushed. like, genuinely stressed out. I would say, yeah, probably 4 as well. I could have spent a bit more time with it. And Naomi Harris's character, yeah, it's just, every time she opened her mouth, I was kind of like, oh God, yeah, she's doing an accent. You don't hear her speak much in the film, that when she does, I was like, oh wait, yeah, no, hang on. She's doing that. That's her choice. And yeah, I guess I would give it like, oh yeah, I'd give it like a 4 in retrospect. It just feels like, you know, it feels like kids in a candy shop. It's like, okay, you have all this money, go make something fun. So much of the Marvel stuff just feels like a long con. And it's like, okay, we're going to make this so that we can make more money by doing this amount of spin-off and blah blah blah, and it's like, oh, you have to stay engaged, whereas this just feels like they went, oh my God, we get to make a massive movie and just threw everything at the wall, and I appreciate that, because I had a great time. Yeah, and I didn't feel like I was being taken for a ride, basically, which, yeah, is the feeling I get with all this stuff.
Well, I'm apologise for bringing the average down. 2s across the board for me. I just couldn't see past some of those those flaws, particularly the way that I feel that it's... Of course, we have star vehicles and we have, you know, protagonist kind of centered films, but this is one where it just felt like Tom Hardy was in the film with himself and didn't really give any of the other amazing actors... the film didn't give any of the other actors their time to shine. And as you say, Naomi Harris particularly cut almost completely into irrelevance to the point where you're surprised it's even someone of the stature of Naomi Harris. Maybe my problem was not sitting with you two while watching this film. Maybe that I would have caught a few laughs by osmosis, or maybe we'd have had a Cape Fear situation where you'd have just been the people.
Yeah. It is funny because I don't think... we kept looking at each other very good night, and I think that no one around us was having such a good time like we were having a good time.
At all.
I don't know. Yeah. Maybe we're just on the wavelength for Venom and Eddie Brock, you know? And if that's the case, good. I'm happy to be there.
Yeah, I own it.
You mentioned how there was the mispronunciation of symbiote, or the strange pronunciation of symbiote in the first one. In this one, that gong goes to Woody Harrelson and his pronunciation of the word origin. I think he says origin. Every superhero needs to have his origin.
There's so many wild things. I don't, you know, like Woody Harrelson's performance in this was like jazz. I'm just like, where's he going with this? So I love it. Like, I love the man anyway. I think he's just a pure vibes is how I would describe Woody Harrelson.
Yeah.
And never mind the film. But yeah, I just, you know, I keep saying it, but like, I'm just so here for a film which doesn't pretend to be anything else. I've talked before on this podcast about how much I love Jackass, and I got such Jackass vibes from this. It's just guys being dudes. Ah.
that is a great take, Hannah. Hmm. That's, I will rewatch Venom 2 someday through the prism of Jackass and see what I make of it. Anyway, listeners, if you do go out and see Venom 2 this weekend, let us know what you make of it, whether you're pro or anti, at the usual channels at LWLIs on Twitter or truthandmoviesatTCOLondon.com via email. Up next, we're going into a bit of a Todd Haynes section of the podcast, starting with a new release of his, the documentary The Velvet Underground. Directed by Todd Haynes, this film shows just how the Velvet Underground became a cultural touchstone and much more than just a band. Featuring in-depth interviews with the key players of the time, combined with never-before-seen performances and a rich collection of recordings, Warhol films, and other experimental art in an attempt to create an immersive experience into what founding member John Cale described as the band's creative ethos, how to be elegant and how to be brutal. So, I was so on board with this film. I'm a big fan of Todd Haynes, particularly when he tackles music in his films, like with I'm Not There and Velvet Goldmine, which we're going to be talking about shortly. I'm a big fan of the Velvet Underground, a big fan of that New York art scene in the 1960s in general, and was so wonderfully blown away by this film, that, as you know, the archive, the fact that Todd Haynes starts with Velvet Underground and expands beyond what they are in a way that his films tend to. He's very big on his research. If he does a period film, he's always got an angle on the period. You're going to see Carol, for example, you're going to come out wanting to go and see the photography of Saul Leiter, or you go to see Far From Heaven and you come out wanting to go and watch 1950s melodramas. That's the same thing here with Velvet Underground. I came out with a very long list of artists, musicians, filmmakers that I wanted to go and check out beyond the Velvet Underground. But that's me. I was fully sold on this. Rogan, were you a fan of The Velvet Underground? Do you know what you're getting yourself in for?
Yeah, well, I'm a casual listener of the band. I wouldn't say no. I feel like I found a lot of their music through movie soundtracks, in all honesty. I'd be like, oh, this is really good. And then, you know, I'll add it to my Spotify. But I've never done a deep dive in their music. I'm not a big fan. But even as a casual listener watching this documentary, I felt... it was so expansive, and he is very big on his research and really situated them well within the culture of the time, in a way that, yeah, can be really difficult for documentary filmmakers, I think, because especially, you know, with a figure like Lou Reed, you could have just really dug down on him, let alone the whole band, let alone the time period. But and I enjoyed it. I thought it was beautiful. I thought the way the archive is blended and the use of the interviews, and watching it, I saw it at London Film Festival, and watching it with a crowd, just the moments you could tell the real fans in the audience and the moments that they cheered at. I was like, oh, this must be like really significant. Okay, I'll take a note. I'll take note of this. But at the same time, even as a casual listener, I kind of found myself going, oh, hang on, I feel like that bit was left out, or I would have liked to hear a little bit more about that. But it is a real tricky balancing act, and I still definitely think it's a worthwhile documentary, and I'm not sure if anything on this scale has been made about the band before. So, yeah, interviews, yeah, exactly. So I can see, yeah, that this is definitely incredibly important and wonderful work, and will be like referenced and celebrated, absolutely, just for what it's managed to achieve, especially as they were so disparate towards the end. I didn't really realize how they ended, and unfortunately how many of them died so young. That was like a real gut punch, actually, at the end of the film. But yeah, I thought it was really great. I think that there are definitely people out there who will get a lot more from it, perhaps, than I did. But it's well worth your time, even as a casual listener, or you know, someone who just wants to know more about the period.
I'm really fascinated by that sense of whether casual listeners would, what they would take from this, because we've spoken about music documentaries so many times this year. Summer of Soul, the Sparks Brothers. We've been coming back to this format, and it hasn't, you know, they've all been quite distinctive spins on the traditional, conventional BBC Four format. None of them have been playing it straight. And this is like the flip side to the approach that Edgar Wright does with the Sparks Brothers. We talked about that one, how this is the box set of all the albums. We're going to go through one by one, talk about them in depth. We're going to cover everything from the start right up to the present day. But we're going to be so laser focused on the music and the history of the band. The Velvet Underground is like a prism in the sense of the way that a great band or a great book or a great piece of art can open you up to a whole world of experience beyond wherever, you know, putting you in the shoes of like the little suburban kid who happens to get this album, and then opens up to a whole world of New York art. And it becomes, in a way, just as good a documentary about that scene, the innovations in avant-garde music, all of Andy Warhol's films, most of which I've probably seen on scratchy YouTube uploads, but I've never seen on the big screen in such good quality before, particularly the sort of living portraits that he made, where he'd just come and get the figures from his orbit to just kind of sit in front of a camera, just face on for a stretch of time for a whole reel, but really powerful footage. But then also Todd Haynes brings in Jonas Mekas and the Anthology Film Archives crowd as well, so it becomes this whole portrait of New York at a very fascinating time in its history. A companion, there was a film we reviewed on the podcast a couple of years ago called Boom for Real, which was a Basquiat documentary, at least presented as a Basquiat documentary, but was more a celebration of the scene that birthed him in the 70s and 80s in New York. And it's a similar vibe here, where you can go in thinking you're just going to get a music documentary, but actually you're coming away with a full meal of artistic experience. Hannah, what did you make of this? Were you, and also, are you a, again, Velvet Underground fan?
So I think, like most young people who didn't have a very happy childhood, I was a big fan of the Velvet Underground as a teenager, and used to have this Velvet Underground bag that I carried everywhere with me, and this really unlocked that memory for me, and I was like, my god, I was a pretentious teenager. But yeah, it was funny, I was talking to some friends of mine about it who had also had Velvet Underground phases as teenagers. None of us knew each other as teenagers, but yeah, of these similar experiences all across the world, weirdly enough. And I was like, god, I was very obsessed with the song Heroin as a teenager, for someone who had absolutely no concept of like what a heroin addiction actually was. So I enjoyed it from the point of view of it kind of reminding me a lot of this music that I really loved, and still, I mean, it's still incredible music. In a way, it's so specific and so clearly a product of its time, but it does have this weird ageless quality where, you know, I could listen to the Velvet Underground and Nico, and it feels as kind of interesting and singular now as it did the first time I listened to it. And I mean, that would have been the early noughties, so I'm sure it goes back even further. You know, people that were listening to it for the first time in the 90s or the 80s. I think it has always managed to kind of retain this spark. And it kind of surprises me that there hasn't been a documentary about the band before, because much lesser bands, much less influential bands, have had pretty like reverential documentaries made. And I think it's nice that, I don't know the ins and outs of these things, but if it is something that like Lou Reed's estate control, or you know, whoever's estate controls, I think it's great that they waited until someone like Todd Haynes could step up to that mantle and take this project on. Because I think with a band as kind of complicated as the Velvet Underground, you need someone who really understands that scene and really also knows how to kind of bring in other people who understand the scene. And I was saying about earlier about Jonas Mekas. I mean, Amy Taubin is quite a big voice in the film. And I hadn't kind of realised how involved she was in the kind of that whole like New York art scene in the 60s. And it is just, in terms of the access, it's incredibly, even as someone who's not like super immersed in that world, doesn't really know most of these people, I was like, oh wow, this is really, I can see that these are the people who know their shit, these are the people you want to be talking about this. It wasn't any of, I think sometimes we're talking heads in films, and I think this is definitely the case with the Sparx Brothers, which I did love, but there is a case of like just filling time and just like bringing people in, because it's like, well, why wouldn't we get Flea to talk about the Sparx Brothers? Whereas in the Velvet Underground, it is just like, it's quite, I think it is quite economical about its use of interviews and its use of talking heads, because they all serve a real purpose in the film. There's no one who's just been thrown in there for like the star power. And in fact, there's some people who I think people probably wouldn't be familiar with unless you're very deep into the Velvet Underground. So I really appreciated the kind of restraint that I think Todd Haynes showed in this. And I think the thing that was most interesting to me, and we've touched on it already, is the idea of kind of fanning out to show the world that the Velvet Underground existed in, and how not only they inspired other people, but how they were inspired themselves. I found all the stuff about like Lou Reed and John Cale kind of growing up like probably the most interesting aspects of me, and kind of, I think, learning the genesis of this very singular sound was like absolutely fascinating, because they really don't sound like any other band before or after, which is no mean feat, I think, to create something that even, what, 40, 50 years later still sounds like nothing else.
Absolutely. And actually, on the point about the talking heads, it's a very simple decision, but a profound one. Todd Haynes only interviewed people who were actually there at the time. That was his proviso for his interviewees. So that's what creates this time capsule, beautiful time capsule quality. And it doesn't have that moment where it's Paul Morley or some modern day broadcaster type saying, you know, talking about the importance. It's all about putting you, situating you in that scene. And even within that, it's quite easy to talk about the way that it fans out and expands out. But it does have, as you say, Anna, a really great through line talking about the relationships with the members of the band, and the way that Todd Haynes uses sort of superimpositions of different footage, and at the same time, sort of multiple tracks through history. So he puts in parallel John Cale growing up in the Welsh Valleys as a piano prodigy, alongside Lou Reed growing up in the suburbs, you know, brought up on television and Bo Diddley and all those 1950s chrome cars and everything, and how very different, there's such different worlds they came from and how they came together. And then a take on the band that's quite subtly kind of quite subtly weaving through this, a sort of teasing criticism perhaps, or leaving the door open to whether Lou Reed was just living a life so he could write about it in his songs, but really ultimately he just wanted to be a rock star, and he had daddy issues, and that was why he couldn't always work with Andy Warhol, why he was kicked to the curb eventually, why John Cale is unceremoniously, you know, dropped after the second album as well, and why Lou Reed eventually leaves the band as well. And we don't have much of the time after the band, there's this amazing sort of firework sequence almost, where it's just this throwing of imagery and album covers and snatches of dialogue about what comes after 1970. But I think Todd Haynes has got his take on the band that's woven through quite subtly there, that's quite fascinating. Rather than just what we said on the Sparks Brothers episode, what's great about the Edgar Wright film is that he is there saying, this is the greatest band and you're going to agree with me by the end of this film. And you are convinced by the end of that film. I don't think Todd Haynes has that ambition with this film. It's something a bit more complex, but all the better for it, I think. But let's put some scores on The Velvet Underground. Rogan, what scores would you give this?
I think 3 in anticipation. I like a music doc, but again, I was just a casual listener of this band. I would say probably 4 for enjoyment. And I think, yeah, I'll go for 4 in retrospect, because I think I'll revisit it. I think I'll go and listen to the albums now and then revisit the doc and just... you know, have more of a reference point. But I will say one thing that I really enjoyed, actually, the bit where they talk about flower power and how much they hate hippies. That was the best bit, watching that with an audience, because people burst into applause. Where I can't remember who said it. They said, you know, if someone is coming out with you with a gun, you cannot hand them a flower and expect them to, you know, not kill you. And I thought that was just a really great sort of distillation of the band and their fans and the energy. I'll go like 3, 4, 4, I think.
Hannah, what are your scores?
I think a 3 in anticipation. I've been burned by music docs more times than I can count, and I think that the worst thing to happen to music docs in recent memory is Nick Broomfield. But I trust Todd Haynes. I trust him to kind of take me on a journey even when I'm not particularly interested in subject matter. And I can't say I was like gagging to see a documentary about the Velvet Underground. I didn't see it in Cannes because I was just like, I'll catch it eventually, you know. It wasn't one that was like high on my priority list. But then I think probably a 4 enjoyment. It felt like I learned something, and as an adult with a very short attention span, it's not often I get to say that. So full credit to Todd for actually retaining my attention for 2 hours. And I do appreciate trying to do something formally interesting whilst not going like hog wild with the flourishes. And, you know, it could have been very easy for a film about the Velvet Underground to be kind of very, ooh, we're trying to be lightly read and be all experimental and weird, which is, I don't think it does feel like that. The intro is pretty out there, but like I was into it. And then I think in retrospect, probably a 4 as well. It's one I wouldn't really hesitate to recommend to people, especially anyone with a kind of interest in that time period, that scene. I really appreciate the kind of mastery at hand here from like all involved. I think it is, it's an ambitious thing to make a documentary about one of the kind of most iconic bands of all time. And I think that Todd is a master of going big, but then also kind of knowing when to show restraint. And that this film is really kind of a testament to that.
Yeah, so how best to describe this film for me? This was my Venom 2. So I'm going to give this 4s across the board. I was very excited about this film. I was very much all in, and it really exceeded my expectations. I reviewed this for the White Lies website when it premiered in Cannes. I was able to sneak into a screening here in the UK and loved it then. I've not had a chance to rewatch it since, but it has just grown in my estimations. So this might even be a 4-4-5 by the end of the year. You know, I don't like to give 5s too haphazardly. But one thing that's really bolstering my love of this movie was talking to Todd Haynes, who is such an eloquent and generous and warm interviewee, so knowledgeable. And even though we only had maybe 20 minutes, we covered so much ground, talking about some of the things we've already just touched on in the review section, the set, the archive used in the film, the interviewees, the take on the band and the art world that surrounded them. So let's have a listen to my conversation with Todd Haynes.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Todd Haynes, thank you so much for speaking with
Absolutely.
Me.
Absolutely, great to be here.
I don't mean to be facetious, but I've been such a fan of your work, particularly when you cover the music industry. To me, you feel like the filmmaker working in fiction film who's probably our greatest music critic across Superstar, I'm Not There, and of course Velvet Goldmine, the way that you tackle stardom, fandom, the music industry, the struggle of the mythic proportions that musicians take on. And now you're doing Velvet Underground in the documentary format, and I wondered, how did this project come to you, and what attracted you to tackling it as a documentary?
You know, it was really, well, thank you for that question. I appreciate that. This one really came to me as an invitation and a question with Todd from David Blackman at UMG Polygram, where the masters now reside for the Velvet Underground. But I think it was after he had spoken to Laurie Anderson, who had moved Lou Reed's archives to the New York City Public Library. So some things were shifting into the public access, and they wondered if it was an opportunity, a time to do a doc on the band and who she would feel comfortable approaching as a potential director. Now, I never made a doc before, as you accurately stated, but I was immediately down for it. I wanted the challenge, and I thought this could be really interesting.
Absolutely. And so you'd worked in very fictionalized or very fiction-based music films beforehand.
Yeah.
So what were the sort of benefits and maybe challenges of working on something that's more authorized, where you have the music, the access to talent, or access to archive this time around?
I mean, the archives is what distinguished this film, the avant-garde films, and the films of Andy Warhol. Mm. That's really, in the most radical way, in a way that the more I do interviews about the film and talk to people about the film, I'm like, there's no other band where this would be the case, period. Mm. So it absolutely distinguishes this subject and how to approach it. But also hands me, the director, this opportunity. I mean, the thing I wouldn't have necessarily known going in, I knew going in that this world of avant-garde cinema existed and that this band had a unique relationship to that world. But I didn't necessarily know we'd be able to get it all, that people would let us, that we could share it with a viewer without citing it until the end of the film, which of course is hugely important to me because it has to be cited and acknowledged, and the names of the filmmakers and artists and the dates in which they come from, where they come from, is so important. But there's something really beautiful and mesmerizing about being lost in it as you watch it and kind of wanting to know more about where it came from later. I didn't know that those permission creatively would be extended to me. And it was. So it was just such a rich and inspiring set of terms and languages that we got to play with.
Mm. And when you're doing that research, I know that when you're making films like Carol, you're diving into research around the period and photography of the time and so on. But with this, when you're working with music, you're working with some new interviews you're making, and then you add the Anthology Film Archive, Filmmakers Co-op, Jonas Mekas, and Andy Warhol on top of that, which for me as a film and music fan who sat down to watch this documentary thinking I was getting a music documentary, it was such a gut punch to see these amazing films I've never seen before on screen.
Right.
How do you then figure out the skeleton of the route through it all, as well as balancing the figures and characters of the dramatist personae?
You know, it's as everyone says, and it's true, it was true for us, and I think it's true for all, for any documentarian I've spoken to, the editing of the film is the writing of the film. Mm. And so you're moving sort of forwards and backwards. It's sort of these looping processes that take you back to the material that you've collected and forward into what that material is telling you the story is. That doesn't mean there aren't criteria that every documentarian is trying to preserve or even established through the process. For me, the criteria was really from the very beginning, and this is sort of true for the fictional films I've made about music. It's sort of starting with the idea that, like, what is the visual language? This is a movie we're talking about. And so I always want to try to find the most appropriate, and that, of course, it's always subjective, so it's what is appropriate to me and what I think of or feel about the music or the culture that it sort of set in motion or defined, what is the visual language or the cinematic references that best get to the core of what that musical artist was doing in their genre and in their character. And so with this film, we had this amazing catalog of films, but it was a balance between we also had fantastic interviewees and incredible narratives that were being recorded. I think I told my editors, we just have to keep the music and the images leading the experience and have the words there sort of peripherally and almost feel like the audience was putting it together themselves and not just following the oral histories. But like I said, it was an embarrassment of riches because we had so much great material on all sides.
Mm. And that's what's so wonderful about this film for me is that in a similar way to how albums of the day were gateways into a whole world of art, this film, as you say, presents us with so many avant-garde music, so many sources of film and art. And I suppose you say that the material and the period helped define the style, and you're using these frames within frames, presenting these images side by side, which is such a radical thing within music documentary, where mainly it would be a producer at a mixing desk pulling faders up and down, although I do love those sorts of films as well.
Right.
So is that what you mean by the archive informing the look of the film, the feel of the film, this use of frames within frames?
Well, that was a sort of parallel. I could have seen full frame usage of the avant-garde films in this film as well, and still have had the images feel like they're leading you. But because it was starting to happen also within the 60s and within Andy Warhol's films in particular, starting with Chelsea Girls, which he began as a dual projection film that runs about 3.25 hours. He has two projectors going. One begins, and so you have the single frame on the left of the screen and everything else is black, and then the second projector starts, and so a second image joins the first, and then at the end of the film the first projector on the left ends before the second going black. He would continue to play with that same idea of the diptych in other films that he would make, but at the same time he's creating these live shows with the Velvet Underground that are a band on stage, another canvas, another screen that he's projecting onto, and all over the band, he would have multiple projectors showing multiple Warhol films. He would have strobes playing. The first time ever that strobes were being used, the first time a mirror ball was being lit since the Prohibition era. And colored gels playing as well. And then live dancers, Mary and Gerard, doing their whip dance down below. So it was a crescendo, a kind of full assault on the sensations of the viewers and the participants and the dancers in the room in ways that nobody had really ever seen before. Other filmmakers were also playing around with multi-frame formats, with images that would move, you know, using the optical printer, which all of a sudden opened up all these ways that you could put frame images within images and manipulate them on a frame. So that was happening as early as the late 50s. And it would make its way into narrative filmmaking, the multi-screen compositions that would be serving a narrative, a dramatic narrative film. So we were just like, oh man, let's just go for this, you know? Yeah. But honor the, what you see in the film constantly is the aspect ratio, the 1:3:3 aspect ratio or Academy aspect ratio, that is the 16mm frame, is the guiding shape that is being used multiply in different ways across the whole film.
Yeah, there's so much to surprise and delight fans in this, and I wondered in the process of researching, doing the interviews or the archive, maybe focus on the interviews for 1 second. Was there any interview that particularly was an epiphany for you or where you learned something you didn't know before?
Well, yeah, my criteria for who to interview fell into the same kinds of dictates that I approached to the film as a whole, which was really about committing to the time and place that the Velvets existed and were putting out records. And that was a brutal but clear way of disposing of countless brilliant musicians and artists who could tell you how the Velvets influenced them and what they meant. But I said, no, let's just do this, and we'll try to get everybody that we can. And we started with Jonas Mikus, who had turned 96 years old. Yeah, yeah. So he was the first interview we made in 2018. And it was the last interview he would be alive for, to be filmed on. But I would say Jonathan Richman blew my mind because he was a witness. He was there to a degree I had not realized, first of all, that he was literally at 60 to 70 Velvet shows in Boston. He became their sort of backstage mascot, teenage driver, friend, you know, assistant, whatever. So he was just constantly a witness to this band during all of its, you know, very important formative stages. But he served as a musician. He served as a music critic because he's so artful and he's playing his guitar and demonstrating what the sound meant. And he was a fan. So he also served that unique perspective, you know. So that was pretty wild. And he was so grateful for how generous that band was to him, which is another side of the Velvets you don't particularly expect.
Yeah, there's such a purity to him, both on record and as a person,
that
within the amazing set of all the interviews you have, he does present that fan's point of view as well as the personal touch.
Exactly.
Which is such part of the whole recipe. So wonderful. And I do want to ask about what I love about I'm Not There and Velvet Goldmine and this film is the way that you find this delicate midpoint between, I wouldn't want to say hagiography or iconoclasm. You're not really elevating or undermining a band or a musician in this film. You're presenting a different sort of point of view. It doesn't come across as it doesn't come across as fully unvarnished, but it doesn't come across as a full celebration. So when you're handling that tone about how to present a legacy of a band and people who maybe have great importance within the pop art world, but also have detractors or have, you know, various stages of their career where they were probably out of favor. How do you find that tone in between all these things?
I would say, look, I have my own feelings about the music of all the subjects of the films you just mentioned, and it's a factor. There's no way it couldn't be. But I think it's, in the case of the dramatic films, I'm Not There and Velvet Goldmine, they're very much about the cultural impact that these artists make, right? But I think in maybe in all these films, I think the key for me is to leave places where the audience can put stuff together themselves. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's why I didn't want too many people telling you what to think or how to appraise this band, so that you're going through it. It wasn't until I heard Lamont Young's Drones and watched Andy Warhol's early films that I felt, and I knew all this. I'd done the research and interviewed all of the subjects, but all of a sudden, I recognized it myself. The influences that were crossing over mediums from music to art, music to film, and that's what I wanted to go for. So the audience can make their own discoveries, and then they feel like they're not being told what to think, and they can think for themselves. And I think that's true for the dramatic films as well, and other strategies of playing with narrative and playing with myth and playing with artifice in those films.
Mm. We've covered about how the structure, the tone, the skeleton, the look of the film came out of all this research. But are you a fan of music documentaries in general? Do you watch those?
I do.
Are there any that you were watching and reacting towards or against when making this film?
You know, usually when I'm doing something of my own, I'll do research about the period and the history, and then I won't really want to watch other examples of the kind of film that I'm making, particularly by contemporaries. Like, I just kind of want to be in my own imaginary space that I feel like I'm inventing. And also, it meant a lot about going deep into this time and place. So I was watching films from the era more than I was watching new documentaries during this time, and now all of a sudden, since there's been one released almost every hour while we've been making this movie, I have a lot of docs to catch up on. I saw Summer of Soul, which I thought was just so fantastic, and that's the most recent doc that I've seen that's been out there, music doc that's been out there.
Yeah, that's a knockout of a film as
incredible.
Well. Incredible. On the level similar to yours, where it's just the sound and the music and
and a lost. I feel like ours was in some ways, but not literally, the way those tapes were literally boxed and forgotten about for decades and then unearthed. So you could have an experience completely presented to a contemporary audience afresh. I did feel like this visual language and culture of the avant-garde was endangered and was not, you know, necessarily... It was drifting from our grasp, and so this film was an opportunity to bring it back into people's experiences.
Absolutely, and such a success in doing that. Before I wrap up, I'd love to ask about Velvet Goldmine.
Sure.
We're talking about it on the episode. When you look back on that film now, what is it that comes to mind about it? Of course, there's, you know, quite a big production as well, and there's a well-storied one as well. But what is it that comes to mind when you think back on that film now?
It's hard. I haven't seen it in a while. But I consider this film, the Velvet Underground film, to be the prequel to the Velvet Goldmine film. Obviously, there's no way. And the Kurt Wilde character that Ewan McGregor plays is kind of an amalgam between Iggy Pop and Lou Reed in terms of his relationship to Bowie, and maybe more so Lou Reed in the kind of romantic, aspirational kind of meeting of artists aspect of that film, but that they both are about unearthing and trying to commit to film histories of queer culture that have that have made certain musical moments possible, and that I find remarkably that those queer culture, and queer is an imprecise word to use about the Velvet Underground era. And the Velvet Goldmine era, you know. It's revisionist, but we'll use it anyway. But those ideas are pretty radical and overt and demonstrative. And yet it's amazing to me how I think even people who saw the movie, the Queen movie, what's it called?
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Thank you, Bohemian Rhapsody. Like, we're like, oh, I didn't even know he was gay. even though it's called Queen. Mm-hmm. Freddie Mercury is singing in falsetto and is mincing up and down the stage in his sort of village people look with his handlebar mustache, and before that in his sort of veils and flimsy clothes. You know, sometimes how radical the language is in front of you vanishes when music becomes canonized, especially when it's associated with stadium rock and other forms of sort of big musical experiences, mm-hmm. and not maintaining that fringe standing, which the glam rock era did more so, but which the underground period of the 60s did the most.
If I could quickly, while I wrap up, ask about Bowie. So I think Velvet Goldmine, even though it's heavily fictionalized, does capture the sense of Bowie and Brian Ferry and other figures of that glam era were co-opted or subsumed by the mainstream, mm-hmm. and came back on the scene in the 80s and 90s, very tanned and beautiful and pretty. Bowie then, of course, did have a comeback later after Velvet Goldmine was made and had a very artistic end to his career. What did you think about that final phase in his career?
I think Bowie just continued to keep us on our toes, mm-hmm. and continued to try to find... I mean, all these artists, and Lou Reed is no exception, I think needed to experience success and a certain... touch that wall of real commercial success. And then by doing so, realize the value, if they had forgotten it for a moment or not, of where they came from and of the experimentation that got them there, and realize that they occupied that entire trajectory, you know, and had to go back. And maybe we would have seen more of those returns in Lou Reed had he lived longer as well. But Bowie, I think, just was too curious a mind and too vital a creative character to not be always asking questions of himself, you know, and while experiencing the sort of full gamut of what a successful musical career could mean.
Thank you to Todd Haynes for joining us to talk about The Velvet Underground and providing such a great segue into the film club this week, talking as well about Velvet Goldmine, which does share one word with The Velvet Underground, but is a slightly different film, a bit more of a complicated film to set up. So let's do some synopsis before we jump in. Glam rock star Brian Slade, played by Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, fakes his own death and is later exposed as a fraud. A decade later, in 1984, reporter and former fan Arthur Stewart, played by Christian Bale, is sent out to expose the truth behind the myth and track down the former rocker. So this is a heavily fictionalized sort of essay on the glam rock era with like a Hall of Mirrors approach to various figures of the time, like David Bowie, Lou Reed, Iggy Pop, Brian Ferry, T-Rex as well, Mark Bolan. They're all sort of in there if you want to go the whole hardcore footnote route, but let's talk about it a little bit as a film as well. Hannah, had you watched this before? Was this a first watch for you?
Yeah, first watch. I'm very familiar with the film just because I don't think you can be a kind of queer person and not knowing what Velvet Underground is. Velvet Goldmine, sorry, is too much Velvet Underground chat. But it's one that I just never got around to watching, as there, you know, it's just so many films. And I think I was maybe just waiting for an excuse. So I was glad that we picked it for Film Club, because it just gave me that kind of impetus to finally sit down and watch it. And I mean, I'm glad I did. I think it is... maybe the cult status it has is a little bit OTT. people really, really love this film. Fans are very vocal about this. And for me, I think coming to it from a like, okay, well, this is a masterpiece, isn't it? Because people love this movie. And I was just a bit like, oh, okay, it's a mess. Not necessarily in like a disparaging way. I think it is just, it's trying to do a lot of things. And I was reading about it last night in bed after I'd watched it, and I saw that David Bowie refused to let them use any of his music because he didn't like the script, which I think is just so funny, because I totally, watching it, I'm like, yeah, man, I can understand why he wasn't into this. It is kind of all over the shop. And I think the fact it tries to... it's basically like a series of kind of these vignettes about this rock star who was very successful and went through all these kind of different periods and different personas, very much like David Bowie, and then just, you know, disappeared from public life. But it's also about Kristen Bell's character and how he came to terms with sexuality because of the music he was listening to. And it's also about Ewan McGregor's character, who was the sort of, how would we describe him? The
So Ewan McGregor is kind of commonly, so this is where we don't want to go too far off the deep end, but he is sort of Iggy Pop at the same time as he's Lou Reed, right. At the same time as he's Mick Ronson, Bowie's guitarist as well.
Right, that all makes in sense. One. He's the kind of, what's his name? I'm going to redo this, but Brian Slade, I keep forgetting his name. Brian's not a very rock and roll name, is it? No. So, you know, he's the kind of bad boy rocker to the sort of more angelic Brian Slade figure. But I just was like, my attention's been pulled in so many directions, I found it very hard to focus on kind of what's going on. But I tell you, yeah, I can totally appreciate why this film would mean so much to people, especially the time it came out, I think. You know.
Well, I think after us talking about the documentary just now and how that is so controlled and so in control of everything it's trying to say and the world it's trying to present to you, this is the opposite of that. It's just so energetic and in love with its ideas about the glam rock era, its take on all of the icons and how maybe they built up this dream that the suburban kids could buy into that was really just a fad or really was just something commercial for the bigwigs at the record labels to sell, and then move on and 10 years later would be a completely different commercial act. It's got all these ideas in there. I can really see, I think I'm at times when I watch this and afterwards when I go and read up on it, I can be tempted into being part of this massive fandom because it is one that really asks you to not only fall in love with all of the performances and the costumes and the music, but also go away and try and figure it out, because it is that sort of slightly imperfect film, maybe very imperfect film, where you're trying to figure out not only what the film's trying to say, but also who it's saying it about and what this is meant to relate to historically. Mm. So yeah, as you say, Kurt Wilde, the bad boy, it is is this amalgamation of characters, but what actually happens, the sort of relationship between him and Brian Slade, the Bowie stand-in, never really happened with Lou Reed or Iggy Pop or Mick Ronson.
To our knowledge,
but that's why I think that this is very much about situating yourself in the shoes of Christian Bale's character. It's sort of like a Citizen Kane for the glam rock era, where he's the journalist who's going around and interviewing all the people who are still standing about their takes on this era and these personalities, trying to piece together the story. But also at the same time, there's a great shot, which is kind of a fictionalized dramatization of the thing we hear in every other trad music documentary about Bowie or the glam era, which is when he was on Top of the Pops, you'd be there in your front room with your mum and dad saying, something's changed. And there's a great moment where Christian Bale, they do some trick of the camera so he looks like he's really tiny, like a little boy, and he's pointing at the TV saying, that's me, I'm a bisexual. And it's something really, that's, you're situated in the fans' view about who these huge rock stars and what their mythologized stories, you know, how that happened, which is really fascinating from a music point of view, because music nerds like history and they like facts and the factual approach, but there's something really to be gained by having this fictionalized one. It is funny, Bowie probably didn't like the script for many reasons, but also Brian Slade is such a passive character. Stuff happens to him and he's kind of outed as a fraud, never really shown to have much talent, and then reinvents himself as a Reaganite pop star in the 80s, which is sort of the Bowie arc. I can understand how a Bowie fan could feel betrayed by that, maybe in the 1980s and into the 90s, where Bowie just was a different artist to who he was in the 80s, in the 70s, where he did signal a sexual glam rock revolution. And already, see, this is what this film inspires in me, is this route into music criticism, which is so biopics rarely do this. Biopics are all factual and more about performance and more about history rather than inspiring conversations about our own relationship with these icons, with their music. And that's what Todd Haynes does in this and I'm Not There, the Dylan film he made as well. But as a film, it's also wild because it's so 1998 as a film. All of the actors are so young and so beautiful and clearly on the up. You have Ewan McGregor just off the back of something like Trainspotting, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, you have Eddie Izzard, you have Toni Collette looking so young, Christian Bale looking like a child, and but also none of them doing their own accents, and they're all doing terrible accents.
God, yeah, there's some diabolical accent work in this film. I just don't, I mean, what was the need, guys? No one would have minded if you just all done your usual accent, but I don't know. I mean, I love the idea of telling a story about a specific moment in time through the eyes of someone who was kind of like on the fringe. You know, it reminded me a lot of Almost Famous, which I think is a kind of, it takes a similar approach in that it's, I mean, that is all set kind of at one time, but this is similar in that it is, you're kind of more with the fan than you're with the band. And you're kind of, I do like that you kind of see the reverential respect for them that Stuart had for them when he was younger, but then the kind of way it turns, and I think that happens to all of us when we get older, we realise that our idols are human and it can be quite a difficult process and you feel a bit betrayed, and I think you definitely see that with him and kind of the seeing these, you know, these massive rock stars as actual people who are as flawed and kind of sad as everyone else in the world. And it's one I would really like to see, like, in the cinema with an audience, because I don't think it hit me that deeply just watching it on my own at home. But I think in a room with people who kind of love it, it would definitely kind of play differently.
Absolutely. I think one thing for me that makes it harder to love is that so much of the soundtrack is pulled from Roxy Music and Brian Eno. So it's, I prefer Brian Eno's solo stuff to Roxy Music, but I'm not a huge Roxy Music fan. And so seeing these clear Iggy Pop, Lou Reed, David Bowie stand-ins singing Roxy Music songs, it's a bit, it breaks my brain a little bit. And I probably would, if Bowie had allowed, because I think Todd Haynes went and said, we'd like Ziggy Stardust, Moon Age Daydream, and, you know, went with like five songs. And you can probably, watching the film, know the exact sequences those songs were meant to be in.
It does, it breaks my heart a little that Bowie didn't like the script enough. You know, so he wouldn't let them use the music. I also think it's funny. But, you know, then you think about some of the films that Bowie's music has been in, particularly since he died, and you're just like, oh man, like, at least Todd Haynes comes from a place of like respect and kind of there been meaning behind wanting to use these songs. Whereas some of the times when I've heard Bowie dropped into a film, Jojo Rabbit, I just want to like kind of, you know, tear my hair out. As a huge Bowie fan, I think it is, is something that really grates on me, this kind of like just throwing a Bowie song into a film because you can, because it's David Bowie. Whereas I think this is a film that there is a reverence for the time and the music and the artists, but it's not afraid to kind of be critical as well. Like we said, you know, it is kind of laying bare Bowie and the idea that sometimes maybe David Bowie did do things for the money. And you know, I think it is definitely an interesting film. You're never bored. I think you're confused frequently, but you're never bored with this.
Rogan, I know you've not had a chance to watch this film. Is it on your radar? Is it something you'd like to watch one day? Have we convinced you at all?
It's quite a
qualified recommendation, maybe.
Yeah, no, definitely. I love films about pop stars. That's like a big thing for me. I also love pop stars acting in films. I like that's also, you know, for better or worse, I always find it really fascinating. I'll definitely be checking this out at some point. And also, yeah, I did like see stills from it, and Christian Bale does look like a child. It's kind of insane to think, like, I don't know, just who he is now, or, you know, just where he's gone from this. And by the sounds of it, I really hope that he does something as a sort of strange and, you know, passionate again. But yeah, no, I'll definitely be checking this out for sure.
And you say passionate. This is very much 1998. Lots of nudity. It's very hot and horny as a film. And it is one of those, if you're watching Marvel movies now and wondering where all that has gone, go back to this film for something that's legitimately...
They didn't leave anything left. They didn't leave anything behind.
This is right in the middle of Ewan McGregor's phase, where I think he had a full frontal shot in every film he was in the late 90s, right? So, yeah. But, yeah, Velvet Goldmine, I'm a big fan of this film. I'd love to watch this in a mini-season with films like Inside Llewyn Davis. These films that do take a period of music history but have a sort of essayistic spin on it. And there you have it, listeners. Velvet Goldmine, Velvet Underground, Venom 2, Let There Be Carnage, all the V's this week. Let us know what you make of them at the usual channels at LWLies on Twitter, truthandmovies at tcolondon.com via email. Next week we have June, The French Dispatch, and for Film Club we're going back to 1980 for Flash Gordon. Hannah Rogan, thank you so much for joining me this week. It's been such a pleasure talking through these films with you. And listeners, please subscribe wherever you pod. And if your podcast player of choice lets you leave reviews, we'd love you to leave one for us too. That's it for this week. We'll see you next time.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.